Welcome to Building My Legacy Podcast. This podcast is designed for leaders and entrepreneurs who want to leave a legacy and will provide strategies that focus upon key elements for legacy creation, determining your desired impact and its benefit, increasing your legacy's reach by engaging key stakeholders, planning, prioritizing, and executing. Here's your host, Dr. Lois Sonstegard.
Welcome, everybody, to today's Building My Legacy podcast. I have with me today Mason Harris. I had the privilege, actually, of meeting Mason at a meeting in Dallas. It's a Vern Harnish meeting on scaling up. So for those of you who are looking at how do I grow my business, this is what Vern Harnish is all about. And that's where I met Mason. He has written this delightful book called The Chutzpah Advantage. Now, he is from New York originally, now in Washington, D.C. So he has great wisdom from just having lived in a culture that's all about chutzpah. And so we're going to talk about that. But before we get started, Mason, tell the audience a little bit about yourself and how you got into this.
Sure. And thank you, by the way, for having me on. I'll do what I can to make sure that our audience is engaged and feels that this is both educational and entertaining for us. As far as my background, yes, I'm from New York, and I hope too many people don't hold that against me. New York had some advantages. The big city, the need to learn how to have your private space in a city that was packed, in subways that were jammed, in streets where as you walk by people, they were brushing into you. So you learn kind of how to find your way to be alone while surrounded by many, many people. There's a kind of a reputation about rudeness from New Yorkers that really isn't true. I think that New Yorkers tend to get to the issue more quickly. So I know, for example, growing up in New York, I did a trip back with my wife a couple of years back, and we went to a deli around lunchtime to order. And I know that when you're in that line and it's your turn, they say next, you should have your order ready. And the funny thing was I gave him my order, and my wife was looking up the menu and started asking questions. And he looked past her and said, next, to the next guy. Because there wasn't time. There were too many people in line. So we learned to adapt to that pace. She did, by the way, get her order. And she had a better sandwich than I did because she thought about it more carefully.
Now, my background. You see that as being open and responsive. To a lot of people, they would see that as rudeness, right?
Yes, yes. I just see it as, you know, I'm in a place that's moving at a different speed than if I am in Atlanta, where people are slower and take their time more with speaking. Both have their positives. And our ability to adapt to where we are and to the local custom says more about us than about the people who are there. So I don't see it, as I said, I know a lot of people think, oh, New Yorkers, boy, some of them are rude. I go, yeah, you have rude people all over the place. It's just a function of living in a city with that many people and not a lot of space. My background, I grew up, I went to college in New York, and I went to graduate school in upstate New York in Buffalo. Earned my MBA over there, and then started with a corporate position, moved to entrepreneurial roles, sold those businesses, went back to corporate, and then went back to entrepreneurial. And my book, the one that you so nicely held up for the audience to get a look at, The Chutzpah Advantage, came about because of the pandemic. I had decided to go back full-time to public speaking, keynoting. And speaking mostly about my business experiences. And I picked a kickoff date of January 2020. Well, by late February, the pandemic had hit. I was actually in Vegas when the news was starting to get really bad. And by March, everything that I'd worked on had been canceled, postponed, which was inevitably canceled. So after so many hours of watching Netflix and thinking to myself, this Tiger King stuff can't really be real. People aren't really doing that. I figured my brain was rotting. I had better put it to good use. And that's when I decided to write The Chutzpah Advantage.
So The Chutzpah Advantage is, I'm going to just hold it up again because it's a great read. And chutzpah, you know, if you haven't lived or been in New York, you really, I don't think, understand that so much. And part of, you know, when you were talking, I was thinking to myself, when I lived in New York for 2 years when I was doing my first graduate degree. And to me, chutzpah included things like brazenness. You can speak it as you want. I can go many different directions. And so I'll kind of play this middle road, tell you this, move here, tell them that. So there's also that negative connotation that comes with it. With it also to me comes a sense of cleverness, but cleverness in a good way. Being able to see through things, speed, and then responsive. So talk a little bit about what does that mean to you?
That's a great observation. First, there are both negative and positive sides of chutzpah. I look at chutzpah as a skill set. And by the way, chutzpah is universal. When I've spoken around the country, and I'd ask the audience, if I was in New York, I would expect 80% of the hands to go up and people even to shout out their answers. Maybe there'd even be a couple of fistfights, this being New York. If I was in, and I actually was in Oklahoma, and I asked the same question. And as I asked that, I thought, I wonder if this is the right crowd to ask about chutzpah. But half a dozen hands went up a little more tentatively. The answers were good. And I even got one answer that I absolutely loved because I hadn't considered that. And that gentleman said gumption. Okay. And I thought gumption is a good word. It can be brazen. It can be audacious. It could be bold. A lot depends on how it's used. So I think in terms of constructive and destructive chutzpah. And I think of chutzpah as a skill set. And the book gets into 8 key behaviors and characteristics that create the skill set. Now, like many skill sets, it can be used for good or bad purposes. And then people shake their head. They go, give me an example. So if you and I were to go through a software programming course, because we hear about the big money being paid to these developers by unicorns out in San Francisco, we're saying, oh, I'm going to learn how to program code and I'm going to move there and I'm going to have a lot of money and a great lifestyle. Well, when we're done, you can use those skills that you learned and you might create business applications, ways to make companies more efficient, track expenses, forecast deliveries, help in supply chain. All of this would benefit people. I, however, might choose to use those exact same skills and create ransomware. Now I'm holding organizations or people's computers for ransom, unless if they paid me. So it's the same skill set. It's our ethical makeup that chooses how we implement the skill set. And chutzpah is like that. There are people who use their chutzpah for negative purposes and for positive purposes. There's in the book, I talk about 2 businesses. They happen to have been in New York. One involved a person who really didn't have access to a good education. He was more of a street guy. But by the time he was 19, he was earning or netting $2 million a year in his business.
Or what was he doing?
He was a drug dealer. Yes. Now, I contrast this with somebody else who created a business in the, I'll call it the health club industry. Started by coming up with a way to exercise that brought about tremendous results, teaching classes in parks, eventually moving into a facility where he was streaming classes, recording classes. And when we think about that industry, it's a $40 billion industry. You're going against very large giants, people who can squash you because their legal budget is more than you can even comprehend spending in your business or generating. So I think about those 2 entrepreneurs, and I say in the book, I'd love to have coffee or lunch with the person who built that health club business, because that's a story of chutzpah, of startup, of bravado, of risk-taking, of putting it all on the line. And that appeals to me. The drug dealer, yeah, it's startup and it's logistics, but I don't know that I'd really care to be across the table from that person. And of course, the interesting thing is it's the same person. The person who was making $2 million a year when he was 19 ended up going to jail. But the skills that made him successful in this criminal enterprise got him through prison. And then when he left, he had lost 70 pounds in prison exercising. He was asked by fellow inmates, can you teach me how to do that? You can help me turn my life around when I get out. He did. He couldn't find a job when he was freed from prison. And by the way, he had a purpose that was going to get him out of prison. He wanted to turn his life around because he'd had a son just before being sent to prison. And that became his purpose for surviving, because he wanted to be a better father to his son. And purpose is one of the key elements of my chutzpah model, by the way. So he gets out. He can't find a job. He decides he's going to do what he did before. He's going to network. He's going to meet people. He's going to give business cards instead of to Wall Street types who he thought might be interested in drug usage. He was going to give it, as he calls it, women in yoga pants, because he thought they'd be interested in his exercise classes. And that led to a facility. And that also led to his hiring employees who were also ex-cons, because he knew of their difficulties finding jobs once they were released. We want people to turn their lives around, but we make it difficult for them once they're free because they don't have access to the same jobs. So I thought this was a great story showing both sides, the constructive and destructive ways that people use a skill set, in this case, their chutzpah.
You know, I hadn't thought of that as being housed in one body, right? That tremendous difference from the negative to the positive, that switch would be in one person, which is a fascinating conversation by itself, because we tend to, as you say, put limitations on. So when somebody's had a bad experience, what we consider a bad experience, we tend to avoid them, push them aside, keep them away, for fear of what they may bring again. So, you know, part of that chutzpah is also having an openness to look and to see something different.
Mm-hmm. Look, find something different, but also stretch our personal and societal boundaries, I believe, is an important component of chutzpah. The idea that this is what's expected, or this is what the experts tell us, this is the advice we keep getting, but we know, we feel intuitively, there's something different that we could do, a way to solve a problem differently. You have chutzpah. You and I grew up in an age that I will call very patriarchal. Okay, so the challenges facing both of us as we were educated, as we made our careers, were different. You had different barriers to break than I did. And here you are, you're an author, podcast, you're an educator. That's chutzpah, because a lot of people might not have felt comfortable stretching those barriers, being turned down for a variety of reasons that had nothing to do with their skill level, but had to do with the way they looked, the being male or female, where they were from, did they have an accent? So I give the example as well. People say, does chutzpah imply that you have to be super successful? And my answer is no, not at all. You can be the first person from your family to graduate college. And that took chutzpah, because there are a lot of family members who undoubtedly thought that, what are you wasting your time? Get a job here in the plant. You'll earn money faster. This is how you grow up. This is how you became an adult. But that person who put off the quick money, maybe lower paying than they're getting, obviously, I should say maybe, definitely lower paying than they have as an opportunity with their education. But they put off that money, that opportunity to move out to earn an income so that they can get educated and graduate. That takes chutzpah. So everybody has that potential. It's how do we put it into use? And that's again where those eight key behaviors and characteristics
Let's talk about those eight. You know, the other thing that I remember from New York days is people would say, oh, he doesn't have any chutzpah. He really has chutzpah, right?
Uh-huh.
So there's things in that we want and we value. So let's talk about your eight things, because I think that gets to what those items are.
Sure.
And you do it alphabetically, not alphabetically, but through,
as an acronym. Using the letters of the word chutzpah. So I'll tell you what, they don't necessarily have to go in order. Is there a particular letter you'd like to start with?
Well, let's start with C, carpe diem, because I think that is where a lot of people fall down. They just don't know where the opportunities are and where to look.
Okay. So C, in essence, that comes from my observations of people and what they do when faced with, call it opportunity. So, for example, back in high school, if we took Latin, and by the way, I never took Latin, but I know the words carpe diem, which means seize the day or seize the opportunity. Now, our generation, and generations that followed us, very familiar with the Nike slogan of just do it. Well, just do it is a derivative of seize the day. Okay, so the idea of somebody with chutzpah is the person who both conceives of an idea and then actually implements it. We all have ideas. We go, you know, that'd be a good idea. You know, I like how they've done that. It's fun when I speak with people about Shark Tank, for example, the TV show. And the idea that, you know, I had that idea 4 years ago, and here this guy's on the show pitching it, Mark Cuban just invented it. I can't believe that. That was my idea. Well, the difference was carpe diem. Seize the day, seize the moment, seize the opportunity. It's not always convenient to do that. Sometimes seizing that moment means giving up something else. An opportunity arises for a different type of job, but you're satisfied. Maybe it's not great, but you're satisfied in your current employment, your current position. But someone says, you know, you have a skill. I'm creating a company. I'd like you to be one of the people that joins with us. Now, there are a lot of decisions to saying yes or no to that. But if you have carpe diem, you look at that and you say, you know, this is an opportunity I don't want to pass on. So C, carpe diem, one of the differentiators for people with or who would score highly on a scale of chutzpah is yes. They're ready to move forward, not on everything that's presented to them, because there are too many options in our lives, but they certainly don't automatically think to themselves, no, things are good. Why rock the boat?
We do that a lot. Okay.
I was going to ask, have you had a carpe diem moment in your life?
Oh, I've had lots of them.
Okay.
And every time it's a choice, right? You look at it and you go, is this the one that you want to do it? And for me, probably it's more motivated by a greater purpose. Will it really add value? If it does, you almost feel a compulsion. You owe it to society, to the people that are around you, to do something about it.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's an interesting point as well, because your work is a lot about legacy. So your remark about you owe it to others, that to me is the foundation of legacy. What am I leaving behind and what am I contributing for others? It's not just what I do for myself. It's what can I teach? How can I help? How can I mentor? How can I share some of the wisdom that I have as I continue learning as well? So it's interesting that you said that.
Well, it goes along with your P, doesn't it, for purpose?
Yes. P in this model stands for purpose. The idea behind purpose is that, well, there are a couple of things. One, we have different purposes throughout our lives. Our purpose as a teenager differs from our purpose as somebody with two children or three children and responsibilities moving forward. That chapter was actually one of the more difficult ones for me to write.
Now that's interesting. Why?
Well, the book, I believe, at times is humorous. I've had people tell me it's laugh out loud funny, but it's also very serious in the messages. Well, the chapter moves along with interesting stories, and then that story that opens that chapter really changes course. It's a story about a family, Czechoslovakia, the beginning of World War II. And it's called Seredne, which was the name of the town, the village. And the what happens when war breaks out and the family is and Czechoslovakia is first occupied by Hungarian troops, and particularly the Jewish community in that little village, what happens to them? And things go bad, but not terrible. It only becomes terrible when the Nazis move in later in the war. And then suddenly the family, well, through the years, the family is broken up because the males are sent to work camps for the most part. And therefore some of the brothers are not heard from for a while. The women are home trying to keep the business and the household running when there's less food and resources around. Eventually, the family is sent from that village to a ghetto in Hungary, and then roughly 6-7 weeks later to Auschwitz, the concentration camp. So it's a very serious portion of the book. It's a real change in tone. And then I switch to Man's Search for Meaning, which is a book by Viktor Frankl. I'm sure some of our listeners are familiar with the book. It has been repeatedly voted one of the best 50 books of all time. It is a very difficult book. It was written by a psychiatrist who was also a survivor of the camp. And he said,
required reading for my children.
Right. Okay. So then you're familiar. Then there are two critical components, as he saw, of people who survived as a psychiatrist, as an observer. Now, he and his wife both went to Auschwitz, and they made a promise to each other that they would do everything they could to survive and reunite once the war was over. Now, sadly, his wife was a victim during the war. She was sent to the gas chambers. But he did not know this, but his observations said there are really two primary factors to somebody survive. One was luck. If bad luck interfered and somebody was selected for a gas chamber, or a guard was bored and using human beings for target practice, it was all over. There was nothing that could be done. But if that didn't happen, for those who weren't selected at that time, it was their purpose. It was something in their emotions, in their soul, that was driving them to put up with everything that they had to put up with, so that they could do something when the war was over. So in his case, as I said, the purpose was to reunite with his wife. Didn't happen. I'll give you a business story. That's what the chapter's about. But to show that this isn't about exclusively war, and there are examples from Vietnamese prisoners of wars, American prisoners of war during the Vietnam War that get to this as well. But I did a presentation several years back to a sales team, about 75 people in the audience. And it was a quarterly meeting. They gave out their awards for MVP of the, most sales, highest above quota. And then the last one was most valuable player of the quarter. And as I listened while waiting at my table, because I knew I was going to be coming on stage, they spoke about the numbers and how somebody was 162% of quota and he was most above quota, and this person had the highest margin or the greatest number, or the greatest amount of revenue, and that's why these people winning awards. And then the MVP was only slightly above quarter. And my eyes and ears picked up. Go, huh, I wonder what this person did. And then I learned that the sales rep that won MVP of the quarter had lost his wife to cancer a year ago and had two small kids, and had been a very high performing rep before then. His performance diminished, but the company and his colleagues stuck with him, and he built it back up. And this was his first quarter making quota again. And that takes me back to purpose. as he described it with the award, in essence, he thanked everybody, said, I'm here because my kids need me. So purpose is a critical element of people with chutzpah. If you have purpose, you will end up doing things that potentially you don't think you're capable of doing. And as Viktor Frankl says in his book, we can't control what happens to us. I'm paraphrasing. We can't control what happens to us, but we always have control of our response.
So true, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that's the difference between, do you move forward or are you a victim?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of times I think, especially in entrepreneurs, get stuck being victims and they can't move forward. So I love that example. You also have in chutzpah two H's.
Mm-hmm.
So talk about your H's.
Okay.
I love H's because to me they're like bridges.
Oh, okay. I like that. And in a way, the first H, which follows the C, so that brings us to the word chutzpah, which some people pronounce chutzpah, because the ch sound is difficult for us as Americans. It's not a sound we're taught. We see chai, we see chai tea, we see ch as a hard K for character. We don't see a ch for chutzpah. It's a confusing word. But that first H has to do with something that we're all familiar with, whether we are leaders, whether we are workers. We all handle objections. H is for handling objections on a regular basis. Sometimes these objections, if we're in sales, we know that because our job is to overcome objections. We have to communicate.
Oh, your bridge.
Right, the bridge. Right. Yeah. I like that again. We have to communicate, understand what the buyer is looking for. If we can, try and figure out what truly is the objection. Is it what's being said? Is there something else that's hidden? And this gets into being a selling professional, because the stated objection very frequently isn't the real objection.
Yeah.
And even as a parent, the objections start from the moment our kids can start saying no, and they're toddlers, to the point that they're teenagers and adults. Objections are common. We aren't always in a position where we can tell people what they have to do. Sometimes it's related to creating a cooperative culture. And teams that have to cooperate aren't necessarily in alignment. So handling objections is about creating alignment to getting a project done that is multidisciplinary in nature, for example. So people who have chutzpah learn the communication skills to handle objections. A lot of it comes down to listening better, truly hearing what the other person objects to, listening to understand, not to respond, anticipating objections, which is what the best selling professionals do. They're a salesperson that goes into a call and doesn't expect an objection related to price isn't thinking very clearly.
Right.
Because that's almost universal. Even if your price is great, it's almost, growing up in New York, I don't care what the price was given to me. I always said, that seems kind of high. It didn't make a difference what I really thought. It was a natural response. And so many buyers do that as well. So that's the first
point. Yeah.
The second H, which is at the end of the word.
The other group of people who tend to respond that way are the Chinese. Oh, you know, cannot be.
Yeah, there are cultural differences. Yeah. Absolutely. If you've ever been to a Middle East bazaar, and you're looking at, I like that urn. If you say yes to the first price, you violated the cultural norms. There's an expectation. It's almost like, wow, they actually bought that. Come on, negotiate with me. I want that. That's part of the give and take. That's part of my communicating with you. So there can be cultural differences in how we handle objections. Some people shy away from objections regularly. There is a great article I just read by a woman, Sam Horn. It's on the internet. For those who are paying attention, take a look. And she talks about, for people who are reluctant to confront, what can they say back to move the discussion forward? And it so well fits with handling objections that it's the first time I've spoken about it, because I only read this yesterday or the day before, and I commented on it because I love Sam's work, by the way. I think she's tremendous. Numerous books, a wonderful speaker. But find that article for if you're the type of
course.
Sam Horn, H-O-R-N.
Oh, okay.
And if you think that, oh, you know, I kind of avoid confrontation, I'd rather just accept this. There's an easy way to respond without making it confrontational. And Sam provides this. I won't give that away because we're giving people homework.
So the other H, which is a bridge, it kind of goes along with what we've been saying, humility.
Yes, I know. And it's a surprising one, because when people think of chutzpah, they think of boldness, audacity, confidence.
Obnoxious sometimes.
Obnoxious also, yes. They don't think of humility. Yeah. And I tell the story. It's a sports story, a baseball story, but in essence, humility to me, and it's important for leadership. And by the way, Jim Collins, who wrote Good to Great, one of the best-selling business books of all time, speaks about humility in his leadership characteristics as well. It's the ability to own errors, not blame others, to apologize when we're wrong, and to share credit when credit deserves to be shared. There's the adage, the old adage, success has 1,000 fathers and failure is an orphan. So nobody's jumping up to say, hey, that bad idea that really messed up, that was mine. But suddenly everybody's taking credit for developing the internet. Okay. As we saw years ago, I was one of the first people doing that. So the story I tell in the book, and I don't know how we're doing time-wise, I want to be respectful of our time, but for those who are baseball fans, 12 years ago, on a very pretty evening, about this time of year, maybe a month earlier.
Just for everybody's knowledge, this is June that we're talking about right now.
Yes.
I don't know when they're going to be listening to this.
Right. Okay. So earlier in the baseball season, which is where we are, a perfect game is very rare. To that time in baseball history, or 100 years of baseball history, I think there had only been 20 or 21 perfect games in over 100 years. And a perfect game is defined as a pitcher facing 27 batters, and he gets them all out.
Oh, wow.
There are no hits, no runs, no errors. Nobody gets to base safely. No walks, no pass balls. Nobody gets on. Okay? They're up, they're down. Strike out, ground out, fly out, pop out, whatever it is. They never get to first base. They're just gone. So this was an evening. The pitcher, a gentleman by the name of Armando Galarraga, I believe it was, pitching for the Detroit Tigers, born in Venezuela, a country that does not have a lot of opportunity, but he was a gifted athlete. He worked hard. He got noticed. He was drafted. He made it to the major leagues. And within the majors, he was a good pitcher, but certainly not great. And here he was on this evening that is very memorable for those in attendance and those who learned about it afterwards. He had retired the first 24 batters consecutively out of 27, which means he is now entering the ninth inning. And people had been murmuring and thinking, you know, this is a no-hitter. No, it's a perfect game. That usually starts about the fifth inning on, when the crowd gets a sense of, hey, I wonder if I'm going to be fortunate to be here live when this happens. The first batter up in the ninth inning, he retires. The second batter up in the ninth inning, he retires. There's one batter left. The crowd is on its feet. They're clutching their ticket stub. This is the days before electronic tickets. We could actually do that. We could hold on to a ticket thinking, I'm going to be leaving this to my grandchild if he gets this. Well, there's a ground ball that draws the first baseman off of first base. It's the pitcher's job to cover first base, which is something the pitcher's done thousands of times from the time he was a child. He gets there in time. The throw to him is in time. The batter is out. The pitcher raises his hand. It's a perfect game, except that the umpire makes an error and calls the batter safe. And We think about these athletes, some of whom have been pampered all their lives. They may not be necessarily prone to communicating kindly when they're disappointed. The pitcher turns to the ump, and instead of kicking dirt on him, screaming profanities, he says, "Ump, I was here. I got it." The umpire says, "I saw him safe." He takes the ball. He goes out. He retires the last batter. It's a nice one-hit shutout. But it is no longer a record setting or immortalization in the record books of baseball. He did not make that. And the crowd is done. Within a minute, the replay is being shown. Now, this was prior to when Major League Baseball would allow for a call to be overturned by a video replay. So they had the videos, but the umpires could not change their decision, even if they were blatantly wrong. Everybody goes back. This great mood is gone. And of course, the internet, because there was an internet then, "I can't believe what this umpire did. This is terrible." And by the way, the umpire, Jim Joyce, was a good umpire. He just made an error. He had been doing this professionally for years. He had earned the respect of players. He made an error in this case. He goes back to the locker room. He looks at the replay. He realizes that he was wrong. He asks the general manager from the team, "Can you ask the pitcher to come in?" Pitcher comes in, and the umpire is actually tearful and apologizes. He says, "I ruined this for you. You had this perfect game. And I messed it up. I'll do anything I can, but I am so sorry for what I did. And I know I can't take it back." And the pitcher basically responds with, "We all make mistakes. Nobody's perfect. In essence, you did the best job you could. It's okay." So the ability to apologize, the ability to forgive, they ended up writing a book called Nobody's Perfect and the story of that evening. The two of them collaborated with another author. That humility, to me, tells a story that goes beyond baseball, beyond business. It's about how we interact with people and how the best leaders with chutzpah understand humility. Now, if you use your humility for if you use your chutzpah for destructive purposes, I doubt there's much humility around. Truthfully, it's more like, I don't care who we're ripping off. It is what it is. So,
isn't it?
Bernie Madoff being an example, unfortunately.
Oh, yes.
Okay, we all know $65 billion stolen. Clearly, he had chutzpah. But he also had chutzpah when he started out in his career and created an honest investment company. It's when things turned bad for him, rather than pivoting and staying honest, he chose a different path, this Ponzi scheme, which led to so many people, so many organizations losing money.
Yeah. Mason, we have not covered all of the letters in this acronym. So those of you who are listening, get a copy of this book, because you'll not forget what chutzpah is and what it stands for. And I think it will make a big impact on you. Last thoughts, what would you like to add? What do you want to leave with the audience that we have not talked about that is important?
Well, if they do get the book, and I hope they do, because there are some other key concepts and chapters in there, my hope is that, not that they think in terms of an overwhelming model with, there are 8 things I need to focus on now. God, it sounds like a golf swing. No, you don't have to worry about that many elements. Start with not 8 or 4 or even 2. Start with 1. Pick one of these elements, either the carpe diem or the handling objections or the uncovering need, pain, and opportunity, or trailblazers, zigzag, purpose, ambiguity, elimination, and humility, and figure out which one in my life right now would be most important for my happiness, personal, or for my happiness at work, or for my company. Starting one at a time makes it a lot easier for us to implement, but also to share and make part of the people that we work with, if it's company oriented, or with our family, if it's more personal. That's what I would help people with. It's as simple as that, or as difficult as that.
Well, simple is important. And I think the other thing along with that is once you just plain start, then you start to also pick up momentum. And once you do that, then you're on a roll. Then you can really make things start to happen. Mason, it has been wonderful to have you with us today on Building My Legacy podcast.
Yes. Well, you're impacting a lot of people with all of your guests, and it's really a privilege and an honor to be here. I thank you so much for inviting me on and allowing me to share my ideas with your audience.
Oh, your ideas are fabulous. And so we'll see about getting you back on and sharing more of what it is that you're doing. And for those of you who are listening to Building My Legacy podcast today, thank you for being with us. And be sure to visit our websites as well, www.buildtomorrow2, and also our newest website, startwithcollaboration.com. So thank you, everybody. Thank you, Mason.
Thank you all, and thank you again. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to Building My Legacy podcast with Dr. Lois Sonstegard. To book your appointment with Dr. Sonstegard, visit www.buildtomorrow.com.